Shake and Blake presents Bounty and Deliverance. Aha! Knowing me, Ian Wilson, knowing you, Shake and Blake listenership, aha. Knowing me, Ian Wilson, knowing you, co-host Dave Probert, aha.
Aha. Little unexpected, but there you go. Yeah, fine, yeah. We've gone Partridge.
No, you want some variety every now and again, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. It is the spice of life, as they say.
Indeed so. Anyway, welcome to Shake and Blake, which is a joint podcast between Earth2.net and Geek Planet Online about sci-fi program from the past, Blake 7. And I, for my part, are fine, because there have been two bank holiday weekends in a row, there's been a royal wedding, Osama bin Laden is dead, and that dates this recording pretty well, so that future generations can look back and think, yes, that was spring 2011.
And obviously, because we're British, we're obviously very excited about the royal wedding.
Absolutely, all of us.
Yes.
Every single one.
Everyone in Britain was decked out in Union Jack suits.
It's a good look.
Yes. There's a party in every castle.
Anyway, how are you, Mr. Probert?
I'm very well, Mr. Wilson. Thank you for asking. Since we last recorded, I recorded a little guest spot on the Highway to Mars podcast regarding Blake 7.
Yes.
Which was,
I did listen to a little bit of that, but...
It does get into spoilerific territory. So
that's right. I listened to about half an hour and then switched off.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you have seen Blake 7 before, I always give it a download. There is a link over at the Shake and Blake section of the forums on Earth 2 and on Geek Planet Online. And so there is a link there if you want to hear it. But if you've not seen the show yet, it might be worth giving it a miss, because we do get into quite spoilerific territory.
Mm. But I have heard one of those hosts before, because one of the podcast that I listen to is one of the writers for, is it The Martians Have Landed?
Yes.
That's the project that the hosts do, isn't it?
It is so, indeed.
Yes. Okay. So yes, go check that out. And I, for my part, haven't been guesting on any other podcasts, but hey, that's fine. I've had stuff to do. So. What the hey? Okay, so I suppose we should get into our email feedback, and as I won last time around, I'd like to go first.
Certainly, carry on.
Wonderful. Right, well, I definitely do have stuff to speak out loud about, so without further ado, the email I've got today is from Camelia, who says, "Dear Ian and Dave..." So I like you already. "I just listened to the first four episodes of Shake and Blake and have enjoyed them, except for the ear-blasting kazoo version of the Doctor Who theme, which, due to my headphones, leaves me a little more hearing-impaired every time it's played."
I'm very sorry, I will try to fix that this time round.
I think it was that episode 3 that was the killer. I think it's been subdued ever since, but still... she goes on to say, "I haven't watched Blake 7, but from your show, I feel like I have a fairly good grasp of the story and look forward to a time when I can get a hold of the series in non-VHS format, which is the only Region 1 offering that Amazon lists, and then only the first episode and used, and far too expensive to make trying to find VCR worth the effort. Anyway, thank you for filling some of my work hours with something entertaining and mildly educational. Not sure about that one. I look forward to the next episode. Camellia. P.S. Ian, is there a chance that Adam will ever make a guest appearance? In a word, no.
I would have no problem with Adam making a guest appearance.
It's not so much that I'd have a problem with Adam making an appearance. I'm not sure I could get him sufficiently interested to talk about something he has no interest in talking about. Unless it's to promote his music or something else. But never say never. Put it that way. And as for the main thrust of the email, I think this is something that is a genuine problem, certainly if I'm trying to attract Earth Tea people to both the podcast and the show itself, is the fact that Blake 7 really doesn't have much of a hold on the American... I'm assuming that Camellia is American just because they said Region 1.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea who owns the distribution on Blake 7, Dave?
I'm trying to remember now. It obviously comes from the BBC, but there is a distribution company that does it. I will research it. I will find out.
I was just wondering, because having listened to the 10th Doctor episode of the Eclectic Podcast, you had a guest host on called Hugh, and he was talking about working for a sort of owned like the rights to many, many British shows.
Yeah, but his stuff is predominantly ITV. Rather than the BBC. The BBC do very much all their own sort of stuff in-house for the most part.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it is very much available in this country.
It is, yes.
On sort of Region 2 DVD, but for some reason there just doesn't seem to be the demand for it in America, so...
Well, here's hoping our podcast can create that demand.
Absolutely.
But we can get tens of thousands of people campaigning for... the Region 1 DVD release of Blake 7.
I would be amazed if we got a 10 of people. Because I'm pretty sure that would constitute the entire listenership of this podcast.
Oh. Well, it's early days. By the time we get round to season 4, we'll have it sorted.
We can have 5. Shaking a few off by then. Yeah.
Oh no, we're getting worse.
They all want to listen, they just can't because we've broken their stereo equipment.
In fact, you've broken their stereo equipment.
Well, yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Camellia, yes, for that one...
For that, Camellia?
For that one email. And I suppose, Dave, I have to say that... I have a second email from Brian Kennedy, once again, Mr. Cool B, who says, "Greetings and salutations, Shaken Blakes 2." So that's a very diplomatic way of doing it. He says, "I don't have many comments on the actual parts about the Blake 7 episodes, but as for the ending, wow, podcaster, kazoo player, 1960s Batman movie scene reenactor, clip montage wizard, the ability to watch the Burton/Schumacher films and foregoing blocking them from your memory long enough to review them, brackets, this alone makes you either a super person or a freak or both, the jury is still out, and now on top of it all, parody writing. Is there no end to your talents, Mr. Wilson?" Cool B. P.S. "Dear Dave, I apologise for this letter, as it may make Ian a tad unbearable to work with for a bit, but it was the only thing I could think to write in about to make sure Shaken Blake at Earth2.net got at least one email this time round." Right. Well, first of all, Brian, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, I do love praise, but and for those of you who don't understand all of that, he's kind of listing pretty much everything that I've ever done for a podcast, including last month's ending to Shake and Blake 4. Five, yes. I should say, though, as much as Dave and I do have this friendly feedback rivalry, it would probably be best if the email content was more focused on Blake 7 itself, rather than singing.
We're getting feedback. There's no need to be knocking this back in their face.
No, not at all, not at all. It's just,
email about anything you like.
I just feel mildly embarrassed, that's all.
Oh, you're being British.
I am being British, if it's fair to say.
You have to ramp it up for the American listenership.
I do one of two. anyway, so thank you very much, Brian. Here's hoping you'll keep on listening to whatever it is I have to offer to the podcasting world. So, thank you. So, I've been very British, so as not to be unbearable for Mr. Probert. Okay, well, on that note, Dave, there's a third email. And it comes from Glade Packer.
Packer?
Gentlemen, I've gone away with that for 2 months straight. I just wanted to chime in with a question and a statement. Does Blake always charge through gravity vortexes or anything dangerous and make it unscathed in future episodes? I applaud his tenacity, as that's how I do things nowadays as well. I'm sure to a slightly lesser extent, Glade.
Maybe gravity wells were a regular feature in his life.
Well, maybe. I just doubt it. he says, but I have also learned the value of treading carefully around difficulties. So there we go. Also, when you mentioned incompetent opponents, I immediately thought of why I hated Pokemon. Okay. Okay, we'll go with this.
Okay, good.
The reason I hated Pokemon. Team Rocket. But I won't rant about that, as Blake 7 is far superior to that shit. Okay. Oh, and Ian, would you be interested in writing a theme song for my shows? Just kidding. But seriously, if you want to, that's a mixed message there, Glade. And that's how he signs off his email. So again, thank you very much for the praise, but more importantly, thank you very much for the question, at which point I will hand over to Dave. Is this something Blake makes a habit of?
It certainly seems to be. Keep going on, no matter what the odds are in front of you, or however much common sense it takes to turn back, Blake just keeps on trucking.
So the lesson here is, children, try your best to crash headlong into things, and you'll probably survive at least one season. Okay, well, that is definitely it, Dave. That is three emails in the Earth 2 inbox this week.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to declare an Earth 2 victory, for I have but one.
Hey!
From the lovely Anne-Marie Organ.
Oh, lovely.
And the Reverend Org have sent us some lovely audio feedback the last few episodes. Mm-hmm. But she says, hi, Dave and Ian.
Well. It's to be expected, I suppose.
The combination of an ear infection and now moving house means I haven't been able to rewatch the episodes you're covering in the latest cast. So there won't be any Org-related episode feedback, giving marks out of 7 Avons this time. Sorry. But I didn't want you to lose at the feedback wars like last time, so I've sent you this email to say that I really enjoy the cast, and once we've moved, I'm sure Org and I will be sending MP3 feedback your way again, once we've found the DVDs. Happy podcasting, Anne-Marie.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, so the good Reverend is moving to a new parish at the moment, so
good.
They're in the process of moving house.
Anywhere exotic?
I don't know.
All right. Okay.
It's like somewhere on the outskirts of London, I think.
All right. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, thanks for that, Anne-Marie. Thanks for the support, and unfortunately, wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for us to win. Pull your finger out, Geek Planet people.
I think you need to start openly insulting them more. Because I tell you what, it worked wonders for me.
Well, I'm just not that kind of guy yet. If I lose three in a row, I might just explode. Which possibly means that people will deliberately not send feedback in for the next one just to see what happens.
Well, tune in to Shake and Blake 7, folks. our June episode.
I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Again, a very topical reference. That says Spring 2011.
Is this the one that's going into a time capsule?
Yes. If they can do that with podcasts, absolutely.
Hello, the future. What's it Hello. Like there?
I hope you're enjoying your flying cars.
Is the internet still full of porn?
Right then. I suppose we should get on with our reviews.
We should indeed.
I'm glad to see that you're all behaving yourselves. Tharvin doesn't want you damaged, unless necessary.
We're touched by his concern.
It'll be more impressive if he can hand you over alive.
Man who takes pride in his work.
What do you take pride in, Jenna? Survival.
At the expense of your friends?
I didn't know that you cared, Avon.
He didn't, and he was right.
Okay, the first episode we're going to be reviewing today is Bounty. And I know what you're thinking, oh god, it's him reviewing it, but I'll try and make the synopsis a lot briefer than last month. Because that was quite the marathon session.
Well, yeah, it was a jam-packed episode, though.
Yeah, that's true.
It wasn't like you were stringing it out. It was like, yeah, there was so much that happened in that episode, you just had to sort of put it all in there.
Okay. Right, so, the first episode is Bounty, and we start with Callie and Blake on a planet in a wood, and they're essentially staking out a building, which is being guarded by the Federation's Daft Punk elites. And essentially what they're trying to do is plan a jailbreak. And we can see that because Blake has got Villa's cool box along with him. So there's a lot of props to help them with their mission. And unfortunately, their presence is alerted because they accidentally walk past what is called a listening device, which is really just some kind of proximity sensor. And whilst the head guard, whose name is Chaney, of course, is rather suspicious because such a device has been set off before by just wild animals, they notice the footprint and then start putting the area on red alert. The person that they have in mind is a chap called President Sarkov. It's Sarkov rather than Sarkow, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. He is holed up in a somewhat bizarre castle with an aerial sticking out of it.
I did write that in my notes, a castle with the Eiffel Tower on top of it.
It's a bizarre looking building, whatever it is. It is actually listed on Wikipedia, but it's a building in Kent, if any of you southerners want to seek it out. So he's holed up in there with his aide, who is a young woman called Tice.
Yeah.
And essentially, she is a very much she's kind of brash and very full on with her opinions, whilst Sarkov is a well, what's the best way to describe Sarkov? Verbose, I think.
Yeah.
He doesn't enjoy a good monologue. So, whilst that's going on, and as Blake and Callie reports up to the Liberator, noticing that due to the increase in security, they'll be down on the planet longer than anticipated, the Liberator crew have noticed an unidentified spaceship on their scanners. Gan is trying to contact it verbally, whereas Jenna and Avon are somewhat confident that they can probably handle the situation if it gets out of hand. They do that by kind of preparing their security, and once they actually hear a kind of distress call coming from the ship, Gan readily volunteers to teleport over and help out the ship in question. And most of the crew do kind of say, well, you know, we should be a bit cautious, whereas Gan's all eager to be heroic. So they decide to make sure they're in teleportation range, and he goes across there. And once his voice eventually comes back through the scanners, Evan and Jenna prepare, well, they actually do teleport him back. However, at the same time this is happening, Zen notes that wasn't actually Gan's voice, which Villa hears. So Villa tries to warn them just as the teleportation is happening, but we see some kind of orange light that Jenna and Avon stare at in horror, leading to Villa being very nervous on the bridge and asking Zen for help. And Zen retorts, no, you may as well go and seek it out yourself.
He says it requires a personal investigation.
Yes, to which Villa is really very unhappy about. So he's like, personal investigation. because obviously that is not Villa's forte.
No.
So he arms himself and searches the ship. Meanwhile, Blake and Callie have reached the ludicrous building in Kent, and you southerners. And Blake starts to climb it, as does Callie, but a guard has started to approach as it happens. So we get to see Callie do a badass stunt by leaping off the building to just give this guy a flying chop. So she tells Blake to go inside and guess at the president, while she hides both the toolbox and the knocked out guard. So Blake makes his way in, and he meets Sarkov. Sarkov goes on and on. And just assumes that Blake is an assassin. Blake, for his part, doesn't quite have the common sense to just spit out that he's not an assassin and he's there to rescue him. As Sarkov just goes, look at my collection of 20th century artifacts. Aren't they brilliant? So eventually, Sarkov tries to turn the tables on Blake, and it looks damn near like he's actually going to assassinate him with a revolver, but it's either unloaded or just doesn't work anymore. However, Tice then steps in, and her weapons do work, and it is only once Tice is in the room that Blake is able to explain who he is and what he's doing. And it's revealed that the whole reason Blake has risked his life to actually come and see Sarkov is that Sarkov's planet of Lindor is about to tear itself apart as part of a civil war. And what's the case is that Sarkov used to be their president and was responsible for holding out, or yes, he kind of held out against like the Federation for a good number of years, but decided to put himself up for confidence votes, and he lost it really very badly. So that completely broke his will, and since then he's gone into exile in the Federation, and he keeps hearing that the situation in his absence is fine. However, Blake reminds him he's being told this by the Federation, and reveals the true plan, a true plan that he heard due to the brief amount of time he had the cipher back from Seek Locate Destroy before they changed the password. That the whole thing had been a fix. The Federation had fixed the elections against him and were planning to let Lindor's civil war continue until they could just move in, sweep up, and then invite Sarkov back as a puppet ruler, now that his will has been so completely broken. And they even have a name for it called the Lindor Strategy. So Tice is completely convinced by this, because she still believes in Sarkov, whereas Sarkov has no self-belief left whatsoever. So Blake, I mean, Callie then joins them after that. However, it has been discovered that Blake and Callie's presence has been alerted by this point. So the entirety of the Federation guards have descended upon the odd building, and Blake and Callie need to find an alternative to just teleporting out, because the Liberator is no longer in range. Well, it's not so much it's no longer in range, but there's just no crew on board attending it because of the issues that are going on board the Liberator. So Ty suggests the next most secure place nearby. So they stage an escape. Sarkov is extremely reluctant, to the point of it being annoying, of leaving. And it's only when Blake threatens to actually smash all of his possessions that he reluctantly puts on a teleport bracelet. So Blake creates an explosive diversion as Tice brings out a vintage car around the front for them to escape in. But by the time Sarkov's in, the car has actually failed. And it's one of these cars where you have to kind of wind it up at the front. So it's taking too long when Tice is doing this, so Blake volunteers to do it instead. They're nearly caught by a Federation guard, but Blake leaps into action and just climbs on the side of the car as it drives off. And they're begging for teleportation throughout, especially as they're coming towards a checkpoint, which they have no hope of clearing. However, against all odds, the teleportation field actually works. However, by the time they get up there, they see that there's absolutely no one manning the controls. So, Callie, Tice, and Sarkov go to the main control room as Blake looks around. And he sees Jenna, who looks a bit disorientated, and says, "Oh, the rest of the crew are all dead." And Blake has a hard time believing this, and he then gets sprayed by some kind of vapor gun, which I don't know what it does. It knocks him out, essentially. And when he comes to, he sees he's in a hold with the rest of the Liberator crew, minus Jenna, and all of them have explosive collars around their neck, as it's explained that Jenna double-crossed them because the people on board the ship that Gan went across to rescue is actually the renowned space pirate Tarvin, with whom Jenna has previous with. So, Tarvin is in the employ of the Federation and is rendezvousing with them so that he can collect the bounty that is on the head of the Liberator crew.
And is apparently played by Omar Sharif from Lawrence of Arabia.
He is in Arabic dress, it is fair to say. I looked the guy up, he's actually an Indian-born actor. That was interesting. But yes, it seems that all pirates are kind of men in flowing robes. he would be very comfortable seen within a harem kind of setting. And with the way he was treating Jenna. Yeah. So there's a bounty of 30 million credits for the entire crew. However, he'd get a reduced rate of 12 million if he decided to take Jenna as his own kind of prisoner slash... Actually, I don't want to add a...
Yeah. another slash is very much the problem.
Oh, I walked into that one. anyway, moving on. So, Jenna, by all accounts, seems to be this terrible traitor. And the Liberator crew are a bit cheesed off. However, the more immediate problem they have are the whole explosive colours, because it's something Tarvin as much as demonstrates, not on someone, but on Thin Air, that he has a detonator that will trigger the collar of anyone who comes near them, and just to blow their head off, essentially. So, Villa gets to work on Blake's collar, and in that he's too busy doing that, Avon decides to try working on the door, because he has his own kind of screwdriver thingamy tucked within the sole of his shoe. So, they bicker and argue whilst trying to do very complicated things. Meanwhile, Jenna tells Tarvin that the reason she stayed on board the crew so long is that, and again calling back to Cygnus Alpha, the Liberator contains a lot of materials that are very valuable on most Federation planets. So she offers to go and get them. Tarvin doesn't trust her, so insists that a guard goes with her. Jenna actually knocks this guard out, so you kind of see that her loyalties aren't actually with Tarvin at all. However, as she makes her way to formulate a plan, she's caught by another guard and has to make up a cover story about checking on the prisoners. So she kind of has to actually go in there and face the sincere frostiness of the rest of the crew. Really, the only person who doesn't have complete doubt in her... I'm confusing that. The only person who half believes she hasn't actually turned at this point is Blake. It's very funny watching Avon say, "How dare you betray your friends so that you might survive such an encounter." Jenna keeps on going. She manages to knock that guy out whilst Vera is able to free Blake from his collar. At the same time, Avon is able to open up the door. So, as the door is opened, another guard appears. So Blake throws his collar at one of these guards with a detonator. He detonates it as the collar hits him and kills him. It just explodes. And this means that Villa is going to be very busy, because the crew immediately see that and all turn to Villa and say, "I'm next on the list." So Villa has his hands full of removing the collars of everyone else, whereas Blake goes to upset Tarvin because they're within 10 minutes of docking with Federation ships. He's very nearly caught by a guard, but Jenna blindsides him from the side, so the two of them decide to head to the bridge together. On the bridge, it's the whole actions of Tarvin are really starting to get to Sarkov and Tice, to the point where it's revealed that Tice has had a kind of PPK in her boot the whole time, and is threatening to shoot him, but Tarvin does some quick deception and just knocks the gun out of her hand. The gun falls to Sarkov, who looks ready to shoot the guy, but Tarvin holds up his detonator because Tice is wearing one of these collars and says, "You won't be able to react fast enough because just like one dying spasm and I'll blow her head off." And Sarkov is really wrestling with what to do until Blake and Jenna surprise him from behind. Tarvin tries to blow Blake's head off, but Blake simply laughs in his face. And as Tarvin spins round, Sarkov shoots him. And
You missed a bit where it turns out that Tice is actually Sarkov's daughter.
I was literally just about to say that.
I do apologise. That
that's all right. It turns out that Tice is actually Sarkov's daughter. You know that already now.
Sorry.
So the episode... That's all right. So the episode ends with Sarkov and Tice teleporting back down to Lindor in order to stop the Civil War and make sure the Federation don't take the planet over.
Bracelet count two.
Bracelet count two, absolutely. And it ends with... I don't know, some confusion about Callie and Jenna about who to trust or something, and Blake says, "Come on, what are you standing around for?" And thus ends another 70s television program.
Do I detect from your fatigue as this was going on that you didn't completely enjoy this one?
No, I really did enjoy it. It was really just the ending that was very kind of, "Wait, what? That's how you're ending it?" And I literally mean, "Come on, you two, don't just stand about." As the two trade glances and smile, I'm like, "Yep, that's the 70s. But on the whole, I really enjoyed the episodes. I found Sarkov to be a little grating.
Clearly auditioning for Doctor Who. He's dressed with a big floaty coat and wide brimmed hat. He's driving a vintage car.
Yes.
He might as well be John Pertwee. White haired man in Victorian dress driving a vintage car in a sci-fi show.
Yes. There's not much more to say. I did like because I obviously you kind of have a first half of the episode story and a second half. I did like the way that the kind of rescue of Sarkov then tied in with the Tarvin subplot, because in a way you got to see another side of... You got to see the back history of Jenna and her smuggling routes and the like, whilst you also got to see Callie get to show off her action chops while she's on this mission with Blake, because, I mean, of all of the crew, the two people you think are most suited to field work are Blake and Callie, just because it is in their blood to be, you know, freedom fighters and taking on the mission. I'm not saying the rest of the crew don't have their strengths, because obviously they do, but it was nice to see that tandem.
Well, yeah, they do make a good team. And also, again, you see Callie's telepathy coming into play as a covert strategy.
Yes.
A way of alerting Blake to danger without actually having to call out to him.
Yes, very much so. I mean, that's the first line of the entire show.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, it's a nice callback to that. And again, it always shows, you know, one of the reasons why Callie is useful, not just because of her fighting experience, but because of that little extra edge she brings to the table as well.
Although, she does actually note at that point that her skills were a bit phasing and she needed to practice.
Yes. Mm. Although, what is up with that coat she's wearing? See, like, yes. All throughout this time, like, Blake is wearing the whole kind of surface clothes outfit they've kind of established is their sort of, you know, away mission get-up. And Callie has worn this that outfit before on other missions. And yet, in this one, for some reason, she's sporting some sort of fur coat knockoff she's picked up from Primark.
She had a weekend with Joan Collins.
It's not even a sumptuous fur coat. Well, Servant had a sumptuous fur coat.
Yes, yes.
But Callie just looks like she's picked it up at a charity shop. We've never seen her wear it before. I can tell you, without being a massive spoiler, she never wears it again.
Oh, sacre bleu.
So it's just like, why is that there? Why have you made her wear that? That doesn't make any sense. But then, yeah, as we've already established, the costume department in this episode made lots of intriguing choices.
Oh, Avon's new outfit was something I had to make a note of.
Oh, what, it's a black outfit, isn't it?
Yeah.
The black outfit with the silver trim.
Yes.
I like that. It's one of my favourite Avon outfits.
Oh, yeah, I find it very fetching.
It really suits him.
It does. Avon does look good in black. But
he does lend himself to it.
He does very much lend himself to it. I obviously couldn't pick up the fatigue in my voice, but I just think it was that last minute that I was a bit confused by. Because obviously earlier in the season, Jenna had a great mistrust of Callie. And then throughout the second half of this episode, Jenna appears to have betrayed the rest of the Liberator crew. So I thought they might have gone a bit more into that, but seemingly it was all shrugged off with a smile. And
well, it's the Scooby-Doo ending again, isn't it? I mean, we had that at the end of Breakdown as well, didn't we?
Yeah, and it was worse with Breakdown.
It was a lot worse with Breakdown, it has to be said.
Well, you have six cast members laughing, five.
Well, you're half expecting Orko to come in from the background and do like a crap magic trick just to put the... Put the exclamation points on the end of it.
Thank Christ He-Man hadn't existed at this
point. There were, first half of the episode, little things I liked. I love the little exchange about with the guards about the alarms going off.
Yes, yes.
And it's something I really enjoy about Blake Seven, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before. It's just little character moments for minor characters. Kind of make the Federation as a whole to seem a little bit more realistic.
I thought Chaney was very strong minor supporting character. Because he knew how to do his job. Yeah. And, he was scolding officers for not being more attentive to the situation and, forming strategies on the hop as he learnt that the situation had grown more and more... out of control, and I thought he did a very good job.
Yeah, it's just those little human exchanges going like, we've had the motion sensor go off. Well, yeah, you say that, but last time the motion sensor went off, it turned out to be some sort of small burrowing animal. it's not a big scene. It's not massively signposted, but it's just little exchanges like that, which we'll see throughout the show. Which sort of humanizes people a bit. And it just kind of makes them seem like more rounded characters. They're not just stomping around going, kill them! a lot of these Federation guards are just guys, they're just doing a job.
Yeah.
It's always interesting to think that maybe a lot of these people who are just sort of, average Joe Schmoes, just doing their job because, the Federation pays well, probably have no idea of the kind of unpleasant things that the administration does.
Pays well, opportunities to travel.
Yes.
good pension,
They get dental. I mean, Sarkoff and his crazy 20th century collection, they clearly raided the props cupboard. The BBC generic props cupboard had been emptied out for that. But it's fine, we can put any old shit in the background so long as it's from the 20th century.
Yeah, what's the most valuable thing in... Butterflies! Butterflies! Everyone was doing that in the 20th century.
Well, although it's interesting to note that clearly by the time of Blake 7 that butterflies are extinct.
Okay, yeah.
Because that little speech that Sarkoff gives about natural history.
Yes, yes.
Same as the way originally natural history was meant to be documenting the living world, whereas now it has become a more literal title.
Mm.
So, yeah, strongly indicating that there are now no more butterflies.
Yeah, there we go. Because I suppose the thing about the collection does very firmly put it that this is definitely our universe, but many centuries on. Obviously, we've always known that Earth was part of this, but this just puts a kind of time context on it. It's yeah. like, oh, the 20th century. Look at all of these wonderful things. And Ben, when he points the revolver at Blake, it's like, do you know what this is? It's a primitive firearm. Yes, but very effective as its job and the like. And you do almost think that Sarkov is actually going to shoot Blake.
Yeah.
Because he does pull the trigger.
Well, I think it's one of the very savvy things that Terry Nation did, is he never actually gives a year of when this is all set.
Mm.
So you can have lots of references to the past, but yeah, he's essentially future-proofed it, because obviously one of the big problems with any kind of science fiction when they establish a future history is, you know, it will inevitably come and bite you on the arse.
Space 1999!
Yeah, well, I mean, like, look at Khan from Star Trek. And the Wrath of Khan. In the original series episode, Khan is apparently the product of eugenics experiments, and there was a massive eugenics war carried out in the mid-90s.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I must have slept through that. I don't know about you.
I just assumed it happened in America.
But yeah, but Blake 7, there's no real dates given.
Mm.
Also, I think it's very implied that Sarkov's collection wouldn't necessarily be allowed on Earth, because he does state that not even on Earth would there be so many 20th century things gathered together in one place.
I suppose it goes back to the whole sensory deprivation kind of thing that's in Earth, because obviously most of the citizens of Earth are doped up to the eyeballs on suppressants.
Yeah.
And the like. It's kind of... have you ever seen the film Equilibrium?
Yes.
I kind of get that kind of feeling, that anything that could kind of provoke emotion in someone is immediately punishable by being shot in the face for a book. And that's not a spoiler, because I haven't said who shoots who, but there you go.
But yeah, I think there is possibly some comparisons to be drawn to the Federation and the regime in Equilibrium.
Mm. Yeah, except you don't have Christian Bale doing gun catter in Blake 7.
No, you get Avon speed mincing. that's the closest you get to gun catter in Blake 7, speed mincing.
If that is the closest you get to gun catter in Blake 7... then there's quite a difference in quality.
Well, again, I don't want to say anything without spoiling future episodes.
There
could be a full-on gun catter scene coming up by Series 3.
I look forward
You'll go,
to it.
You'll go, ah, screw you, Equilibrium, Blake 17. <Yeah. laughs> and on a similar subject, screw you, Battle Royale, Blake 7 did it first. We have exploding collars.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, if we're moving on to the second part of it, I mean that was a very clear and present danger to the point where it's one of those things where I'm not sure who would actually be better suited to the task, because you've got Villa, who's the computer expert, but
Villa's the lock expert.
Sorry, Avon's the computer expert, whereas Bill, as you say, is the lock expert, but he has to know something about circuitry for some types of doors, because obviously some of them are computer activated. So it was very interesting watching Avon have a go at the door, whilst Villa was having a go at the collar. And it led to some very frayed tensions between the two.
Yeah.
As they were doing it, because there was obviously a very real threat of what would happen if it went wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Venom isn't particularly happy with being appointed this task, is he?
No.
Could you try and unfasten this thing around my neck, which will probably explode if you do it wrong, killing both of us?
I trust you, Villa. Oh, because it'll explode if I force it. That's why I trust you, Villa. And, yeah, Aven has a very wry smile at that, as he is.
But yeah, I mean, although I think it's nicely telling that this is the first time that Villa essentially just tells Avon to shut up.
Yeah.
Because of all the crap he's been taking from Avon up to this point, yeah, he's under a stressful situation. He's like, "Yo, Avon, just shut up, will you?"
It's essentially because they've just finished arguing, and Ben Villa goes, "Avon, shut up, because I really need to concentrate on this." Because obviously, unlocking the door is not quite the same kind of pressure scenario. Well, it's not. In fairness, it's not just Avon. I mean, Gan, in frustration, actually threw something down, causing everyone to jump. I can imagine why he might be frustrated, because in some ways it was his eagerness that kind of led to the situation.
I actually think that's a really interesting scene when Gan first decides to go over. Mm-hmm. Because I'll be like, out of all the people on the Liberator, I think Gan is the most inherently good person.
Yeah.
Or certainly the least cynical. You know?
I suppose just a bit over Callie, yes.
Gan hears a ship in distress, and Gan goes, "Right, I'm going to go help this ship in distress." Whereas everyone else is like, "Whoa there!
You want to help someone in need? We need to talk strategy here."
Yeah, well, this could be a trap and all sorts of stuff. Mm. Gan takes things at face value, which, again, makes him a little naive, but, especially in a very cynical world as, we have in Blake 7. You kind of, will there ever be a time when Gan goes and genuinely helps someone and it turns out that they do genuinely need help? But also, the fact that Gan is willing to take his own life to protect the rest of the crew as well. When he beams over there, he says, if there's danger, if it's terrible, fire on the ship. I'll tell you to fire on the ship.
I've got to say, I did love the small scene between Zen and Villa, where Zen's like, "That voice is not Ola Gan." And Villa's jaw just drops wide open. It's like, "Oh God, what do I do?"
Shit.
Yeah. But the thing is, Avon was saying, "Do get ready to blast that ship out of the sky." And Villa really doesn't want to do it because, as we've known, he and Gan are quite good friends. And, he can't really bring himself to do it, whereas Avon's going, "Villa, tell me whether or not you can blow Gan out of the sky." He's like, "I guess." But once he's heard that, he has the slight dilemma, does he say or anything like that? And eventually he does have to send a word down to the transportation bay, but by that point it's too late. And going back to the scene where Ben tells it needs personal investigation. to the extent that Villa just says, "One of these days I'll get Avon to personally investigate you."
Well, I think it's a nice nod to kind of the way that Zen works as well, because he clearly doesn't have any internal sensors, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could detect damage to computer systems and external damage to the ship, but he couldn't actually tell you who's on board.
Yeah.
Well, if somebody else intrudes on the ship, Zen doesn't immediately set off an intruder alarm or something, because he doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, in my notes I have that down as unhelpful, but I suppose in fairness, if he doesn't know the situation, then he's of limited use. That's the thing. As soon as Blake beams back on board, he's like, "Where is everyone? They're not on this flight deck." "Yes, where are they though?" "They're not on this flight deck."
Yeah. You do get the feeling that internally, Zen's entire view of the ship is just the flight deck. If it's happening off the flight deck, he's got no idea.
Indeed. So, and then we have Tarvin. he's an interesting character.
Oh, man alive. I mean, Tarvin should be a badass. Now, this is the guy who's done something that even Travis couldn't do. He's got on board the Liberator, he has control of the Liberator, he subdued the crew. That is the first time somebody has done this. And yet he is dressed like an arse. Any kind of threat that Tarvin may pose to the crew is immediately disabled by you going, that's Omar Sharif from Lawrence of Arabia, what the hell is going on?
That's not something I've ever come across in history books. The Arab War was lost because the British soldiers just couldn't defeat many arses on camels.
It's a perfectly acceptable way of dressing if you're in the fucking desert. These people are space pirates. Yes. They dwell in space, on ships, pirating. Why are you wearing desert gear? You bunch of idiots.
It's a look, I suppose.
All the Amigans are just really camp. Oh, darling, you look fabulous in that robe.
The softest of silks. He's not a perfect character, but I mean, it's very interesting.
The character's pretty good. I mean, like, you know, the play he's having with Jenna and the fact that he's doing all this, but I'm just being distracted by the fact that his costume is ridiculous. And it just takes away from what should have been a really awesome character. I mean, especially that when the Amigans are first mentioned as being sort of, you know, pirates and mercenaries and bounty hunters and stuff like that, they, oh, yeah, yeah, these guys are like badasses and stuff, but then all of a sudden these fey Arabs walk in.
Like, now, there are two words I'd never thought I'd hear together. Fey Arabs.
So, yeah, these guys should have been decked out as proper sort of hardcore space pirates. There must be a bunch of costumes that would have worked, but no. We're clearly having budget problems. Let's raid the closet for the supper used on Beaugest.
I'm not even going to pretend I know what that was, but
it's a book based on the French Foreign Legion, so there would have been people in Arab dress there.
Right, okay. I did like, if we can leave aside the costumes, I did like the kind of angle he had with Jenna, and I mean, theirs is a relationship that is hard to figure out because clearly there is a lot of previous there.
Yeah, there is a history.
Yeah. And to the extent that Tarvin is willing to forego 1,000,000 credits just so that he can take possession of Jenna.
Always like a decent proposal.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't turn down that kind of offer, but, he's doing it for a reason, though.
Yeah.
He's not like, Reno from the last episode, where he's just going, oh, space totty! and has decided to dock another 1,000,000 off for Cali as well. he's not trying to add to his space harem. Put it that way.
1.5 million for the pair, love.
So it's interesting, but I suppose Tarvin has a degree of something to offer Jenna, but Jenna, as much as says, no, I've changed, or one of us has changed, clearly meaning herself.
I think it clearly means Tarvin. You never used to dress like a space Arab. You used to be cool, man. Look at you.
I used to really fancy you, but now...
Hell no.
I'm ashamed to say I... Yeah, whatever. So,
I think maybe she would try to lure him down to the Liberator's Claire's Accessories branch, just so he could try on some of the fabulous costume jewellery.
Yeah. That would make for one fey Arab. But it was interesting as well, just because, I mean, his presence forced her to kind of work as a double agent in a way and make it look like she'd betrayed the Kree, because there's a certain amount of stuff that we just don't see happen. We don't see, I mean, how, for one thing, I mean, Gan's voice is projected from Tarvin's ship, but it's never explained how that isn't Gan's voice. And it's really just like...
Doesn't Gan say they used a voice synthesizer? Or they used his voice pan or something?
Did he mention that?
I think he mentions that after Blake gets captured and he meets up with the rest of the crew and he explains.
Okay.
Because I think Gaz says something like that and just said it was stupid, and then Avon says, well, none of us have been particularly intelligent today.
Yes, there is. I mean, and Avon's had some more great lines in this. I mean, which is probably just as well, because he, to be honest, I mean, his presence is a bit limited in this episode.
Yeah.
But I mean, towards the beginning, when Vila is just saying, oh, I don't like the look of this ship. And Gan, as much as said, oh, God, not again, Vila. Vila says, I'm entitled to my opinions, which Avon says, it is your assumption that we are entitled to it as well that is irritating.
It's a great line.
It is. I'm sorry I butchered it. But, I mean, especially, and going back to his black and silver robes, and he's just got his hand on his chin, as he's just casually putting down Vila as if it's effortless, which I suppose to Avon it pretty much is. Although, immediately after that, he actually agrees with Vila, to which Vila has a kind of theatrical aside, saying, he agrees with me, this makes it all worth it. Okay. That's an odd aside, but there you go.
Well, yeah, but there is that kind of sort of a byplay between the two, but it's just like, all right, finally, somebody agrees with me.
So what did you think of Sarkov and Tice?
I like Tice. I'm always sorry that she didn't become a member of the crew, because I think she'd have been awesome.
Well, it did look like that might have happened in some way, because Blake said, right, Tice is coming with us. And then, like, he leaves, just set off an explosion, and then goes back and says, right, and so are you. And he's like, no, I'm not, sir. Blah, 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 blah. And then Blake's just, right, I've had enough of this, and just grabs his LP and smashes it. And this stuns Sarkov into, well, at least shutting up, for one thing. And then threatens to actually throw the butterflies on the ground. And that is enough to make Sarkov stay. Never mind the fact he can't actually take his butterflies with him. It's like, either way, he's losing them.
But I suppose to Sarkov, it's enough that the collection exists somewhere.
Yeah, I suppose.
All the precious things are together.
I did, I mean, originally I thought Tyson might be a bit insufferable, because she was going on about this guy giving him a gift and saying, oh, he's a social climber, he doesn't deserve it. So, and Sokov's going, oh, no, we remember courtesy. That's very important nowadays. But, I mean, she's right, because essentially her dad has become really self-pitying and pathetic. And he was just waiting to accept being assassinated.
I mean, I'm not a massive student of history like yourself, but is there sort of some sort of similarity with the whole Napoleon being in exile sort of thing?
That's not an era of history I'm very familiar. I don't know if Napoleon had a spunky daughter who's just like, you can't take this kind of shit from Wellington, Dad.
But also, you know, just the idea of, you know, this sort of formerly great leader now in sort of now in exile somewhere,
yeah,
somewhere sort of small and remote and sort of brooding on his achievements and failures.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Sarkov wasn't deposed in some kind of great coup or anything. He lost a rigged vote of no confidence.
Well, I mean, one of the things we didn't actually mention in the synopsis is, one of the things that prompted the vote was there was an ambassador from Auron, Cady's planet.
That's right, yes.
Called Dihan.
I thought it was Shin Lee. Yeah. I wrote that down wrong.
Shamsung.
Fatality.
And, yeah, it was the, he wanted to encourage an alliance with the people of Auron to stand against the Federation, and it was then that the confidence vote ended up getting called.
Yeah. Because he was from Kali's planet, wasn't he?
Lihan was, yes.
Yes.
And so, again, following on with Kali's motivation for staying with Blake, Lihan is still on Lindor because he's failed in his mission.
Mm.
And can't return to Auron.
Same, that's right.
Same as Kali failed in her mission, so she can't return to Auron.
Yes. Well, although wasn't... didn't Kali say she was the last of her people?
Well, she was the last of the people on the planet in Time Squad.
Right.
She was the last of the rebels that were left behind.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
She isn't the last of the people of Auron.
Yeah, sorry, I'm guessing you're new who up here. there we go. So,
From the dialogue of that episode, I can understand why you'd come to that conclusion, though.
Thank you for setting me straight, though, because I've gone at least three episodes thinking she was the last survivor of a race.
The planet Auron is still very much out there.
Is it something we come back to?
It is, yes.
Okay. I won't ask any more then. Any more for any more?
Well, I think the actual Lindor strategy is very interesting. I mean,
yes.
Rather than
yes.
just sort of, you know, marching a bunch of troops in there and taking over and everything, they've gone a much more sort of insidious and political route.
Mm. I mean, for one thing, I very much like the fact that they called back to the time when they briefly had the cipher.
Yeah.
And could glean all this information. Because, I mean, theoretically, that could give them plot points for a lot of episodes, if they wanted to use that.
It would also make sense that because of all the information they were getting, it was like a wall of stuff, and it would have taken them a while for them to sort of sift through what was worth, you know, what was good intelligence and what was just chatter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, makes sense that it took that long for them to, you know, find out about the Lindor strategy and then do something about it.
Yeah. If anything, I suppose I was just a bit surprised they didn't make a bit more of it now that they've established it. But, I mean, at least doing it this once, it's a nice little callback. And it again shows you the insidious nature of the Federation. And they have, like, a number of approaches as to how to take over independent planets. In much the same way that we insinuated that the whole Mission to Destiny kind of plant weed thing came about after they resisted attempts by the Federation to recruit their planet.
Yes. And this is a similar thing again. So basically force out a well-loved leader in a rigged no-confidence vote. And then... because Blake says there's been sort of several different factions on the point of civil war, and you know there's got to be Federation people stirring that up as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Stoking the fire. And then, again, very telling, especially in these modern times, that Blake says that the Federation will move in with what they call a peacekeeping force, who will then occupy Lindor and then just stay.
Mm, with a puppet ruler.
Yes.
Which, interestingly, would have been Sarkov.
Yes.
Because he is very much an inspirational figure. But this would be like not even a brainwashed one, but one who is willing to work with the Federation.
Yeah, just make them more malleable.
Yes, now that he thinks that his own people don't love him anymore.
Yeah.
Although he still has an affection for his planet. And... whereas now Blake specifically has radicalized him, although he very much wants him to regain the kind of persona that he used to have in order to resist the Federation. If anything, it was more just watching Tarvin act like an utter douchebag that really caused Sarkov to kind of man up.
Yeah. Because he does have some wonderfully baiting lines towards Tarvin as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so.
It's like when he asks Tarvin what he believes in, and Tarvin says wealthy as well. There's hardly a rallying call, is it?
Yeah. You'd sell your own grandmother. I did. But only because she was going to sell me. I got there first. Okay. Interesting. But, I mean, he comes up with the point that Tarvin doesn't care how insidious or devious he's had to be. He ends up winning. And because obviously Sarkov was not devious or insidious, but lost. And he notes that, you know, people who win are not necessarily the people who deserve to win. They won through other means, which is always a nice thing to kind of hammer home, that some of the most successful people in life are utter bastards.
This is true.
So it's nice that Tarvin gets his comeuppance in the end. I do wonder if Jenna's seeming betrayal is called upon later on, or if everyone just quickly accepts, oh, it was just a ruse the whole time.
It's pretty much forgotten.
Yeah, because, one other thing I suppose we should say. I'm thinking about the next episode, so...
Oh, right, okay.
Because I suppose I should just say it wasn't brought up in the next episode, so...
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, because Jenna didn't warm round to Callie right away. It took her a good couple of episodes before she finally accepted Callie. And now, again, I'm still confused by the last couple of lines. It's like where Callie
I always took it that saying, like, what she said, Tice said, good luck. And they're saying, like, was that directed at all of us, or was that directed at Blake? Sort of like, you know, does she fancy Blake, basically?
It was just like that. Gossip.
Basically, yes. It's just like two ladies having a bit of a gossip.
And Blake's like, oh, come on, chop chop, can't be gossiping.
Come on, women! Stop this sewing circle, we have a federation to destroy! Put your knickers on and make me a cup of tea!
Gene Hunt in space. I'd watch that.
I've already made that happen.
Oh, you have, haven't you? Yes. I've got to re-listen to that.
Right, so I think that's pretty much us done for that one, isn't it?
Oh, I'd say so.
Excellent. Well, shall we move on then?
Yeah, why not?
There are more important things than Blake.
Not for me.
More immediate, then. Aurak, for example.
Aurak?
There've been rumours about it for years. A scientist called Ensor has been working on it. Despite considerable investigation, we've never been able to locate him.
And you want me to find him for you?
Mm-mm. It's no longer necessary. A little while ago, Ensor's son came to see me. His father was ill. He needed medical help and equipment. While he was here, he showed me plans of his father's creation. Aurak. It is a brilliant achievement. There is nothing else like it in the universe. And he wanted to sell it. Expensive, Travis. He wants 100 million.
100 million? Are you sure whatever it is worth that much?
It's worth 10 times that much. So I agreed to buy it.
Do you have the authority?
No. Now listen, Travis, I've told no one of this. Ensor and his father live alone on the planet Arista. He made it clear that if there was any attempt to take Aurak by force, he would destroy it.
Would he do that?
Oh, yes. He thought it through very carefully. He wouldn't even reveal the location of the laboratory until I'd agreed to all his terms.
Which were?
A space surgeon was to go with him. I sent Marriott.
How much did you tell him?
Only what his orders were.
He's a good man.
Marriott was to remain with Ensor as a hostage until the transaction was complete. I was to get the 100 million, take it in an unarmed ship, and in return, I get Marriott and Aurak.
So now all you have to do is to persuade the Federation to let you spend 100 million.
That could take years.
You have an alternative?
Yes. It occurred to me that if Ensor didn't get back in time, then in a very little while, his father would die. So I took the precaution of placing a small explosive device in his ship.
You said Marriott was on board?
Yes. That was unfortunate, but unavoidable, I'm afraid. Or don't you see? Aurak is ours for the taking.
When do we leave?
Start making arrangements. Maximum security. No flight plan is to be filed. When we do leave, it must be in total secrecy. However long it takes, Travis, you must cover our tracks completely. No one must know anything about it.
Right. You're almost as ruthless as I am.
You underestimate me, Travis.
It begins to look that way.
Okay, so our next episode is Deliverance. In this episode, we begin on a small spaceship. Inside it are two men, Ensor and Marriott. Ensor is transporting Marriott to an undisclosed location. Meanwhile, Servalan is in her office, getting very annoyed at people trying to make her go to meetings.
How dare they?
Bastards.
It's as if that job was required of her.
And she's basically tracking the ship that Ensor and Marriott are on. The ship has a bit of a near miss coming up to a planet called Cephalon. It gets caught in the gravity well. It nearly sort of gets pulled in and crashes, but Ensor manages to steer the ship away. But then something on board the ship explodes. And while they're trying to recover from that, Ensor is trying to get the injured Marriott into one of the escape pods. Meanwhile, the Liberators picked all of this up and they're tracking the ship. They see that the two escape pods have been launched and they end up landing on the planet. And so they decide to go down there and see what's happening and see if they can find any survivors. So Avon leads a team consisting of himself, Villa, Gan and Jenna. They teleport down to Cephalon. They find Marriott dead, but Gan helps himself to his identification and stuff and basically takes his wallet just so they can identify
him. He is a convicted criminal. And he's been hanging out with Villa.
Yes. Meanwhile, Avon and Villa discover Ensor, who is unconscious but alive, and they teleport him up to the Liberator. And they take him to the surgical unit. Callie then brings back Gan, but there's no sign of Jenna. So Blake, rather annoyed at Avon for losing Jenna, sends him back down to go find her.
Yeah, because Blake's never lost someone.
Yeah, she's like, you high-handed bastard.
He was literally growling at the guy.
Yeah.
I think it's more just because Avon was going, ha-ha, I'm going to lead a mission. Are you worried that I might make a better leader? So, in some ways, this is kind of being thrown back in his face.
So, they teleport back down, Gan, Villa and Avon. She searches the planet. meanwhile, Ensor is in the surgical unit and wakes up. Well, he's sort of half awake and he's babbling about his father and needs to get to his father. And he's got these micro power cells, which make an irritating beeping noise every time somebody opens the box.
They sure do.
And he says that the Federation are willing to pay 100 million credits for something called Aurak. And so he gives them navigational coordinates for the planet Aristo, which is where his father is, and asks that they set off straight away. Blake says that he can't because he still has people on the planet who are lost, and goes up to the flight deck with Callie. Ensor then comes onto the flight deck and takes Callie hostage and demands that the Liberator fly to Aristo to save his father. So, under duress, Blake sets a course for Aristo, and the Liberator leaves orbit. So, back on the planet, Avon Villa and gang quickly work out that the Liberator isn't there because nobody's responding to the communicators. They suddenly get attacked by cavemen, and while they're sort of running for their lives from men throwing rocks and Avon's gunning the odd one down, they find a hatch door. And Villa can't get it open, so they're panicking, thinking they're going to have to just fight off all these cavemen. Then the door opens, and they're greeted by a woman called Megat, who immediately throws herself at Avon's feet and pronounces him Lord.
Yeah.
Much to Avon's satisfaction and Villa's amusement. Yeah. And she says that Avon's coming was prophesied. And leads them into an underground bunker with lots of old sort of a... It's like a old rocket silo mission control kind of place. And there is a rocket, which Megat refers to as Deliverance. And it turns out that the people of Cephalon were involved in a big war. And in order to try and save the race, one of their wise men, called Kushel, had come up with a way of saving their race by using gene banks. Although the idea is that there's lots of gene banks in this rocket, so they need to launch the rocket so it can settle on another planet. The gene banks can slowly evolve into people, and they can sort of restart their lives again. And so basically everything is prepared and ready to go, but Megat doesn't know how to launch the rocket, and it seems that the generations of people have apparently been waiting on their own. I don't know how that works. And Avon basically quickly works out what they need to do to get the thing launched. And in return for launching Deliverance, Megat gives them sort of directions to where they can find the cavemen's camp and rescue Jenna. So Avon and Villa again stage a rescue of Jenna, who unfortunately spent the majority of the episode tied up in a tent.
Yeah.
Yeah, get to that in a minute. Mm. And they escape back to the hatch. Gan fights off about three of these guys single-handed, which is awesome.
And he loves this as well.
Has a really good time. So they get back inside the silo. Megat lets them in. Meanwhile, back on the Liberator, Ensor has been growing steadily more and more ill, and because basically it was the adrenaline rush and the painkillers that Callie and Blake had given him, which had allowed him to be well enough to take her hostage. But now he's slowly sort of slipping and dying. So he sets his gun to like an automatic hair trigger. So if he sort of falls asleep or passes out, then the gun will go off and kill Callie. Eventually he drops off, and Blake manages to kick the gun away so it doesn't shoot Callie. Ensor dies. Blake turns the ship around and heads back to Cephalon. So back on Cephalon, Avon manages to get the rocket launched with the help of the others, and then teleports back up to the ship. Don't ask me what happened to Megat, got no idea. Never mentioned again. Again, we'll get to that in a minute. And so they all sort of speculate about what will happen, you know, when the gene banks sort of land on the new planet in 500 years' time, and will Avon's name be spoken in legend? And at the end of the episode, Blake decides to set course for Aristo. Oh, and I've actually forgotten.
And,
they're
not the only ones going to Aristo.
Yeah, because, I mean, as great as this scene is, he's sort of plonked in the middle of the action.
Yeah.
I've told you the linear storyline for this episode, but then this happens in the middle of it as well. Travis is called to see Servalan. Travis is a bit sort of browbeaten and broken because he's lost his command after the events of Project Avalon. Servalan tells him that Ensor has come to see her and says that Aurak is a project by his father, Professor Ensor. There's been rumours about it for ages, but she's offered to pay 100 million credits for it, something which she isn't authorised to do, and states that it's actually worth 10 times that. And what Ensor wanted in return for the information about Aurak and the giving her the opportunity to buy it was a surgeon, which was Marriott, and some micro power cells, which are basically the two things needed to save his father's life. And the surgeon Marriott that Servalan sent was the man who fixed Travis's arm and eye after his altercation with Blake. And Servalan says that basically all we've got to do is wait for Ensor to die. So I blew up the ship and the surgeon and Ensor. So now all we've got to do is go to Aristo, wait for the professor to pop his clocks, and then we could just take Aurak for nothing. Winner. And even Travis is a little aghast at her ruthlessness. Because this entire episode, this entire operation is off the books, and she's acting completely outside of her authority. When Marriott disappears, she's going to have him posted as a deserter. And according to Federation law, any man who's a deserter, his family is immediately sent to slave labor camps. Mm. And Travis is a little aghast at her sort of rather callous behavior. So basically, in order to get his command back, Travis is escorting Servalan to Aristo in order to get Aurak as well.
Yeah.
Right, so that's... My apologies for the rather jumbled synopsis, but I had rather forgotten that rather awesome scene in the middle.
To be honest, I would have had a really hard time synopsizing this episode, so I'm glad you did.
Well, Mr. Wilson, your thoughts on this?
Well, obviously Utopia has a lot to answer for now I've seen this. a setup to the season finale involving a race being launched out into space.
Oh, yes.
Honestly.
Screw you, Doctor Who. Blake Seven did it first.
Exactly. Because Blake Seven owes nothing to Doctor Who whatsoever.
Absolutely not. And if it did, we certainly wouldn't be highlighting it in a section of this podcast.
God, no.
That would be callous.
Indeed. I like the episode on the whole, but I think it tries to do far too much at once. I think due to the fact that they do plonk that Servalan and Travis thing in there, which, you know, I loved. It's a really good scene.
It's an incredible scene.
I'll come back to it, but essentially it's one of four separate plot threads. Going through the course of the episode, because you have, you know, Servalan's mission, you have Blake being forced to head to another planet under duress, you have Jenna being captured, and then you have Avon being proclaimed god by this incredibly horny religious type woman in a technological cave.
She's a very pretty lady.
Oh, she absolutely is. But it's comic relief at the best.
Seeing as there's a lot going down in this episode, let's try...
going down.
Hey! Yeah. Let's try and break this down a bit.
Okay.
So, the initial sort of mission down to the surface of Cephalon, very interesting. This is the first sort of away mission, if you like, that Blake hasn't led.
I'll take your word for that. I'm trying to think back. I suppose you could argue Mission to Destiny wasn't technically led, but I suppose that wasn't on a planet.
But also, Blake was one of the first over there. He was just the fact Avon and Callie stayed behind.
Yeah, I suppose. I'll give you that then.
But pretty much every other planet they visited, Blake's been the first one down.
Perhaps he has an aversion to radiation.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that, because considering he's pointed out this planet has high radiation levels, Blake's like, you know what? You go down. And I'm surprised that Avon didn't go, what? Hang on a minute, you've been Mr. Gung-Ho up till now. The first time the planet's a little bit radioactive, you're like, off you go, Avon, have a good time.
I suppose it just kind of plays into Avon's vanity, because as I said... He kind of sneers at Blake, saying, oh, you're worried that I'm going to do a better job than you? Oh, yeah, Blake?
Well, I'm just a little bit surprised that Avon didn't call him on his obvious bullshit.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, perhaps the radiation would make his curly hair fall out or something.
Well, Gan was fine.
But I mean, the whole radiation element added a kind of time pressure to it at first.
Yeah.
And then there's a character, because they go down, they come back, and they said, okay, if we haven't found Jenna in an hour's time, we'll have to keep going, and after 4 hours, we'll have to switch over. But, and whether or not that underground cave complex shielded them from radiation, I don't know. But it was a kind of time pressure that was kind of forgotten about in some ways. Although Avon did take the Liberator's disappearance being gone rather calmly, perhaps because he, on occasions, has had to move the Liberator out of range to deal with something like Federation pursuit ships.
Although, I have to say, and this, we didn't really mention this in the previous episode, but it happens in Bounty as well, is that, again, the Liberator isn't there to teleport people up when they need to be teleported up.
It's
how many episodes has this happened in now?
Well, that's the bit, I mean... Going,
Liberator, teleport me now! Yeah, where are you?
That's the bit, I mean, I didn't bring it up, because I thought it was just one of the things you took as a given for an episode of Blake 7 by now.
Yeah, it just seems to be like a regular thing now. It's like, oh no, the Liberator's been called away, they can't teleport them back up again. It just seems to be the problem that, yeah, they're the only people who've got to teleport, which kind of makes them a bit too powerful. So in order to add that little kind of extra element of drama, they have to sort of keep removing the thing that teleports them away for various reasons. And I wish I could say it stops, but it doesn't. We're going to get so bored of this cropping up in an episode.
Maybe we should just count the episodes where it doesn't happen.
Not many. First one.
The first one. Yeah, because the Liberator wasn't in the first one.
Yeah, as much as I love the show, it's one ongoing plot trope of the show, which just... Especially when you're watching it in sequence, the more it happens, you're like, oh, God, they're doing it again. Oh, no, is the Liberator going to get called away? Oh, they've just teleported down. What's going to happen now?
Oh, no, there's going to be a moment of peril.
Mild peril.
Mild peril, yes.
PG.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's that part out of the way. So how about the... Ensor taking the Liberator hostage.
I think what was interesting about that kind of plot thread was even at the start when they were going over Marriott's book, you kind of see slight parallels between Blake and Servalan, if anything, because they take a look at Marriott's passage, so, this kind of things gives us clearance for like however many sectors that we are. This could prove very useful. Oh, there's a picture of a woman and some children as well.
I made a note of that as well. Just like, yeah, Blake's just like, he had a wife and kids, whatever.
Yeah, it's but just... we can use this. And, wow, okay.
A bit callous, isn't he, for a freedom fighter?
Yeah. Just a whimsy.
I mean, I'm guessing it's just like immediately he found out he had a AAA security rating. He's like, oh, fuck his family. He works for the Federation. He must be a bastard.
Yeah, that is very much Blake's worldview.
Yes.
And I suppose the interesting thing about... so what's the chap's name? Endor?
Ensor.
Ensor. It's interesting watching his character progression because... We see him at the start with Marriott in the ship and rather jovial and looking forward to where they're going and everything. I mean, they're getting on quite well, considering that one's from one planet and the other is a representative of the Federation.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, whilst he was alive, Marriott was sporting one heck of a unibrow. It wasn't quite a unibrow, but it was so... close that you may as well round up. But, I mean, he goes from a rather chipper person to a fairly confident pilot because there's a kind of swerve that they kind of lose altitude and it looks like they're being pulled into Cephalon. But then the ship recovers and everything's fine. And then all of a sudden, Servland's bomb goes off.
Yeah.
And then you see the scarred and somewhat desperate Ensor play out, because essentially the whole reason he's acting the way he's acting is to save his father's life.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that is very much what Blake and crew were being driven to do just two episodes beforehand. Yeah. Began. And I think Blake was being... I mean, I could understand why Blake was being the way he was being, because obviously there's radiation levels on Cephalon, and that it might put his crew at risk. But at the same time, can he not just quickly fulfill this guy's request and then speed straight back? Because it was as much as said at the very beginning that it would take them 6 days in their very small craft to get where it is and the Liberator. So that would be...
About half hour.
Exactly, pretty much no time at all. So I'm surprised it took as long as it did before the Liberator had to turn round after Ensor died.
Yeah. Now, I don't know about you, I just found it possibly the most boring siege or hostage situation. Every time they cut back to it, like Ensor's a bit sleepy. Blake's like, yeah, I'm going to get you as soon as you fall asleep. He's like, no, you're not. And then it turns out the gun he's got is apparently one of those cheap paintball guns you get in pound shops where you pull the handle up.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I've sent it to a hair trigger now. So really, that's going to fire a paintball.
It wasn't hugely convincing.
It just wasn't very tense. You know, it was clearly meant to be tense, and it was just a bit boring. Especially when there was much more interesting stuff going on elsewhere in the episode. The fact we keep cutting back to this, to basically watching a bloke fall asleep.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it is. It's basically Blake Seven has touched the truck. How long can this man keep awake? He wins his father's life if he can stay awake for the full 12 hours.
Wow. Now, there is a reference I did not see us using. Is that I'm a big fan of Dale Winton's other big TV game show. I'm not talking about Supermarket Sweep. I'm talking about Hole in the Wall.
Oh, yes. Bring on the wall.
That's the thing, because I have a love of the kind of rubbish that BBC One are now putting before Doctor Who on a yearly basis. I love Hole in the Wall. I love Total Wipeout. I was ambivalent towards 101 Ways to Leave a Game Show. Although this year... Have you seen what they've got this year?
I have seen Don't Scare the Hare.
What utter bullshit.
Well, as I said on Twitter, it seems that the BBC are now commissioning game shows based on Vic Reeves' absence-induced nightmares.
Dearie me. But getting back on topic. So.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention like a minor point that tickled me. You know when they find Ensor and Marriott on the planet?
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's not the same actors.
I couldn't tell from how it was shot.
It's shot very discreetly, but yeah. It's not the same. I mean, I understand why it wasn't the same two guys. Because, you know, you're not going to pay an actor to come out and just lie around and be dead.
Yeah.
So they've clearly just stuck them in the outfits. But, you know, you could have maybe like burnt Marriott's body up a bit more or something. And like, you know, they've both got vastly different hair. You know, so it's like, that's not him. That's somebody else.
Well.
But, yeah, it's just something I noticed that tickled me a little bit.
I suppose the thing with Ensor is that you're meant to feel empathy with Ensor because, I mean, as much as Blake has a time problem, I mean, the same is definitely true of Ensor because, you know, he doesn't know how long he's got for his father to live. And even though Marriott's dead, then at least these annoying power cells might be able to prolong his life until he can find another surgeon. And for all, for what all he knows, I mean, the deal with the Federation's still on. You know, he has real pressing issues that is driving him to do this. And again, Blake is completely callous. He's like, no, we can't risk my crew. Not right now.
In all fairness, it's one man's life weighed against four.
That's definitely true. It's just that Blake was being a bit of a dick about it.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, he could have said, you know, I have four lives in danger compared to the one life here. I'm applying the equation. And then Entor could say something about the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't seen Wrath of Khan, means absolutely nothing. And you haven't seen Wrath of Khan, have you?
Okay, fine.
We need to correct this imbalance.
I have this vision that I'm just going to walk into your house one day, and I'm going to...
You're going to be those things like Malcolm McDowell had in A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, I'm going to be sat down in front of your entire DVD library, and you're going to find the most shocking thing that I've yet to watch. And it's going to go in that order.
I'll be honest with you, by this stage, I'm sort of amazed you've seen Doctor Who.
It's on TV on Saturday nights. In fairness.
I only watched it because the video recorder went around for Don't Scare the Hair. Okay, so let's move on to the third plot point here, which is Servalan's machinations.
Yes.
I love this bit. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's really well acted. I mean, like Stephen Grief as Travis, they like really just show it like a Travis, which is still got a bit of fire, but it's had the wind taken out of his sails.
Oh, yeah.
He plays it really well.
He does, yes.
Especially when Servalan is deliberately fucking with him.
Yeah, oh, she is loving it at the bit. I know you said that she might have been slightly flirting with him during Project Avalon, but here, I mean, right at the beginning, she was going, I just deliberately insulted you. Normally you'd never take that. Not even from me. Ooh. And it was really, I mean, this scene for me kind of put Servalan on another level, because in her previous...
Yeah, I was going to say, as good as Stephen Grief is, Jacqueline Pierce is amazing in this.
Well, the thing is, because she's only been in two previous episodes, and each time she's kind of acted as Travis's boss / defender. Whereas here, even Travis is amazed at just how cold she is being, because she purposefully sacrificed a top surgeon, the surgeon who saved his life, no less, and so that no one looks into it officially, is fine with just selling his wife and children into slavery. And as we say, I mean, Travis, he's got a reason to be thankful for this man and what he's done. I mean, ultimately, he can put it aside because the only thing he's got left is getting vengeance against Blake. So that kind of outweighs his concern. But even so, this shows that Servalan is more cold and ruthless than we thought she was previously capable of. And she as much as says in a line of dialogue, you underestimate me, Travis. And Travis is like, yes, maybe I have been.
Yeah, I think it's nice to show that Travis isn't entirely without conscience as well.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, he is fairly uncompromised and he wants to kill Blake and he's on a vengeance trail, but he's not so unconscionable that he can't have some affection and be aghast at the idea that a man... Because, I mean, when she first mentions Marriott's name, he just sort of says, oh, yeah, he's a good man.
Yes. he was a good man.
Yeah. You know, Travis thinks kindly of somebody, which, you know, again, I think adds some depth to his character.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a very subtly played moment from Stephen Grief.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell, you know, internally, he's absolutely appalled, but he can't say anything because this is his shot to, you know, get his command back.
Yeah. I suppose in many ways it kind of, it just really introduces Servine. I'm not saying that she had a minor part in her previous appearances, but this really shows what she's capable of.
Oh, yeah. As a villain, this puts her on the map.
Yeah.
Just yeah. how sort of cold and ruthless. And just, yeah, just the fact she'd dream up the plan in the first place. Yeah, I could pay $100 million for this thing, but the old man's going to die. So all I have to do is, you know, find out where they are, give them what he wants, blow him to pieces, and then just go and take it up from a dead fella.
And the whole reason she's doing this is that she's convinced that this Aurak thing is one of the best things ever, and it's worth 10 times a million credits. It's worth 1 billion credits.
Yeah.
And that's the whole reason she's ruining, ooh, at least 6 people's lives, just so that she can get her hands on this device.
And is it wrong that I found her unbelievably hot during all of this?
Not for a second.
My word. I mean, like, you know, she's plotting destruction and, like, executing people and everything. You know, she's still making me very happy in my private area.
Mine too, sir.
Yeah, she's smoking hot during all of it.
Do you know what she looks like nowadays?
Yes.
And?
Older.
Right, okay.
Well, let's put it this way. She's in her 60s now.
Fair enough. there are no words. But
there's one, it's GILF.
I should admit at this point, I finally dipped my toe into the waters of Twitter this past weekend.
Oh, have you?
More as a kind of professional thing to try and help my career in the museum sector. But the day I joined was the day of the royal wedding, so that made for some interesting tweets anyway. But one of the things that was trending was the word quilf.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
We'll let you work that one out yourselves, folks.
Yes. Yes. I like to think it's code for Pippa Middleton. But
down, boy.
I need to find a way of making that work somehow.
Well, if you have any ideas on how you can make Quilf apply to Pippa Middleton, by all means, email us at shakerblake@geekplanetonline.com.
At earth2.net.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I suppose...
Go on, you know, you need the emails, I suppose.
I don't want your pity emails.
You heard him, folks, he doesn't want your pity emails. I will have your pity emails. So, where were we?
Yes, the fourth and by far the most amusing plot thread. Avon is worshipped as Lord by a very attractive woman in chiffon.
Called Megrat.
Megat.
Megat, right, okay. But even so.
It does sound like a slang term of vagina, doesn't it?
In a way, yes. She is hilarious.
If I said to you, oh yeah, I saw my girlfriend totally naked the other day, I could totally see her Megat, you would know what I was talking about.
Venice, you could pretty much say any made-up word, we'd know what you were talking about.
What, me personally? Are you suggesting I'm a naturally lascivious person?
No, I mean, any man.
Oh, pity.
Okay. I'm not going down this road. I'm not going down this Megat.
That is Megat.
I'm interested why Megat picked Avon over Villa or Gan. Was it just the case that he went through the door first, or...?
I think it's down to Avon's fondness for silver lame jumpsuits.
Okay, I wasn't expecting that response.
Those little hoodie uniforms they all have.
Yeah.
Everybody else is just made of fabrics. Avon's is silver lame. Like, he just looked the most fabulous and glittery.
Lord Avon.
Lord Avon.
As Villa can't resist, Villa has a field day here.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's like, it's fish in a barrel, isn't it? The first thing he says is that I think she's unwell. So the loneliness has driven her insane.
It's only Gan who's rhyming. We still have to get Jenna back in all this.
You do remember why we're here, right?
Because the other plot thread is the fact that Jenna spends most of her time tied up in a tent.
You know what? That's such an inconsequential plot thread that I actually completely forgot about it.
I thought as much.
But you can see the look on Sally Nivette's face like she's going to be phoning her agent soon.
It's like, I'm second build, damn it. What am I doing here? Because she does manage to get free from her restraints one time.
Yeah.
And literally club a man in the head with a rock.
Yeah.
But she's immediately captured after that.
And considering that this is a woman who in the previous episode has, like, helped take down, like, you know, a gang of Arabian-dressed space pirates.
One of them she punted straight in the balls as well.
Yes. Well, I feel sorry for that poor actor. That probably wasn't in the script. We haven't got time to reshoot. Keep filming.
Yes. Keep it down, actor.
You're supposed to be unconscious. Stop clasping your nuts and whining. Oh, my meat!
Oh, God. So that wasn't great. So let's just go back to me cat.
I just remembered something I've written in my notes.
Okay.
The scene where Callie's teleporting everybody back and Jenna isn't back.
Yeah.
It just made me laugh that, you know, she's tried several times to teleport her back, she's not coming up. But Blake's like, well, you must clearly be doing it wrong, let me do it. And starts fiddling with it. And Avon's like, no, you're doing it wrong. It's like two blokes trying to fix a television. It's like, I've already pressed that. Well, you're clearly not pressing it right, are you?
Yeah. It is weird having to sit and watch the same effect three times, completely failing to work.
Yeah.
I mean, because this episode was slightly shorter than the others as well. And
It's got some filler.
There's a lot of filler in there. It's a shame. On the whole, I like the episode. But if you break it down, there's a lot that's just, like, you really wish could just hurry up and be over.
You kind of do get the feeling that it was a couple of half-written episodes slapped together.
Yeah.
In order to make sort of... we have sort of seen this before with episodes in the series where there's been sort of... There's been a more of a portmanteau feeling to it, shall we say, to be a bit more kind. But,
oh, yeah.
But here, here it seems a lot more glaring.
I mean, even just the last episode, there's like two very different stories joined together. I don't mind that way of doing things. It's just with this one, they tried to do too much. It's as if they tried to fit three different plot threads together.
Yeah.
And that was a bit too much. That was more than they were capable of doing. Because that's the thing, because that scene with Servalan and Travis is halfway through the episode.
Yeah.
And I was expecting to see them again at some point. All right. No, that's just like set up for the season finale. As is the ending and the whole Aurak thing. The main thing they had to do was rescue Jenna, and whilst they're there, why not just send a random rocket into space? why not? You know.
I think it's almost kind of sweet that Abel seems to be sort of genuinely quite taken with Megat.
There is one point where I actually think he's just going to lean in and snog her.
Yeah.
And just, like, take advantage of his devoted acolyte.
And then doesn't, which is, again, sort of like, you know, very unable in a way. Like, he's not playing the situation to his own advantage or anything.
Well, again, that's something I kind of wanted to bring up from the last episode, because when Jenna is kind of forced to visit the crew, Avon says, "You do all this at the expense of your friends." And initially you think that line's comical coming from Avon.
Yeah.
But then you remember that in the previous episode, when he was thinking of leaving the Liberator crew, he had a condition of make sure that they're free to go unharmed. So there is character growth.
I would say by this point, it's not the rest of the crew he has an issue with, it's Blake.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, he bears no ill will towards anybody else. I mean, yeah, he'll pick on Villa, but... but, yeah, he doesn't want anything bad to happen to him. But he thinks Blake is an idiot and a nutter, and he's going to get everyone killed.
Yeah.
But, yeah, here, I mean, I think part of the reason is that, like, Miguet is a genuine innocent, you know?
Yes.
There is no pretense. She's not out to get anything. And you get the feeling that Avon very rarely meets someone like Miguet.
Yeah. You know,
but everyone Avon's encountered has had an agenda of some sort. I mean, everyone on the Liberator has an agenda. With the possible exception of Gan.
Yeah.
But then, like, in Avon's eyes, Gan isn't too bright. I mean, he gets on with him by this point and, you know, sees his value, but, yeah, he's not going to be asking Gan for advice at any point.
No.
But whereas, like, Miguet is this, like, you know, just this truly innocent person who genuinely believes that Avon has been sent to help her. And he seems, like, you know, taken by her in a genuine way. He's not, like, looking to take advantage of her or anything like that. You always get the feeling he feels a little bit responsible for her.
Mm. He certainly doesn't feel like punching her out.
No.
So that's an improvement of most of the women he's met since Mission to Destiny.
But the thing that really annoys me is they set all this up and then she just disappears. She's like, what happens to her? We just cut back up to the Liberator.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, you got this woman who's completely devoted to Avon. You know, Avon has fulfilled, you know, his prophesied mission.
Yeah.
What's she done? Is she just kicking around back on Cephalon?
Well...
Is she catching up with her reading? I mean, she clearly didn't go on the rocket because, you know, it's going to take 500 years to reach its journey and it's not really made for passengers. You know, she'd be on a rocket on her own dead.
Yeah.
So it's just like, is she staying on Cephalon or what? I mean, yeah. And, I don't know, it just kind of annoys me because, again, I think we've had so much filler elsewhere.
Yeah.
And yet which means we've had to cut back on something which could have been like a really nice scene. You know, with Avon saying goodbye to Miguel. Oh, look, just having some resolution for the character.
Yeah, I think in some ways you'd have to have them say goodbye because if Miguel stayed around Avon for any period of time, her illusions would quickly become shattered.
Oh, absolutely. But you just kind of get the feeling that Terry Nation had written himself into a corner and didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't know how to resolve her storylines. We're just like, you know what, fuck it. Cut back to the ship. Jog off.
That's the thing. I mean, because wasn't the thing that they were waiting for someone like Avon or this chosen prophet, and generation by generation their numbers were dwindling? I don't know whether that's because of the radiation or for whatever reason, but... Essentially, she was a member of a dying race who were holding out on faith to rescue their civilization. And their civilization is rescued, but in a way that it will, you know, it will regenerate in 5 million years or 500 years or whenever, long after she's dead. So, I mean, if they're just left on that planet, especially now that the prophecy's being fulfilled, I mean, what the hell do they do?
Well, exactly. But
do they just mate with the cavemen there?
Well, yeah, I've got to think it was just her.
Well, she said that there were, like, other survivors, but...
By the time that Avon's arrived, it's just her left? That's certainly the impression I got.
I'm sure there was a line somewhere that said that... there were survivors, like, further back in the caves or whatever, but their number was slowly dwindling.
Possibly. So. I may have missed that, but yeah, it was just to have some closure for the character rather than just like, because it just kind of gives the impression, of, yeah, especially after how taken with her that Avon appeared to be, just like, right, well, it's been lovely, bye.
Yeah.
I'll call you.
Well, that's the thing, because, I mean, where else could she have gone, though? Because, I mean, granted, they could have dropped her off at another planet, but she'd still be...
Well, they don't necessarily have to do anything with her, but just to have, like, you know, a goodbye scene. You know, just tell us what happens to her.
Mm.
Yeah, does she stay in the cage? What's she going to do with her life? And yeah, I think it could have made for a really nice, touching, you know, a chance to show that Avon's got a little heart, you know?
Yes.
And instead, she's just sort of written out and dismissed.
That's another reason why they didn't do it.
Well, just, maybe. Like,
hold back on showing Avon's caring side.
It just, like, for what was like a really nice little plot strand, it just sort of just ended abruptly.
Yes.
It's just like, you know, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then they come back to Liberator, and they go, yeah, and then we launch the rocket.
And then Derek Jacobi regenerated into John Sim. Stole the TARDIS. Head it off.
Maybe that's what happened. Me get regenerated into Derek Jacobi. They wielded out the next rocket for the next poor sap to come along and help them with.
Or Megats was Lucy Saxon. Or Canto.
Actually, the more I think about it, it is really, really similar to Utopia, right?
It is, isn't it?
To the primitive people on the surface. So, the previous episodes, we've had, like, you know, rampaging Arabs. Now we've got rampaging cavemen.
Yep.
I kind of wish the two of them had got into a fight. So, who will I like Arabs, I also like cavemen, but which one's better?
It needs to go on that US war TV show where they pit various armies against each other.
Deadliest Warrior.
That's the one.
The one with these specially written software and advanced bullshit.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is very, very Utopia, the more I think about it. Oh dear.
Oh, Utopia's a good episode.
Screw you, Doctor Who, Blake Seven did it first.
Yeah, it's just very derivative.
And you don't even have Serverland big or hot in it either. Shame on you, Utopia.
Oh, well, at least I know that in the next episode, in the season finale, I can look forward to Travis dancing to the Scissor Sisters. I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome, yes. Oh, that's just a bizarre image in my head now. A man dressed up with an eye patch dancing around that I can't decide.
I don't think there's any more to say after that, to be honest.
There's your go-home image there, folks. Right, so we're pretty much done here, aren't we?
We are indeed.
Well, in that case, let's bring on the Who Count. Okay, so it's a low Who count for both of these episodes, I'm afraid.
I suppose the guest cast in both wasn't very large.
No, it was only about sort of three or four people. But there is a Who count.
Good, good.
So we have T.P. McKenna, who played Sarkoff in Bounty.
The one who was auditioning to be Doctor Who.
Yeah, played Captain Cook in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, which is a Sylvester McCoy story.
Okay.
And in Deliverance.
That's so, it?
Yeah. Who counts of one for Bounty?
Yeah.
And Deliverance, we have Tony Caunter, who played Ensor. He played Thatcher in the William Hartnell story, The Crusade. Morgan in the John Pertwee story, The Colony in Space. And Jackson in the Peter Davison story, Enlightenment. And Deliverance, we have a who count of one.
Wow.
Our two lowest who scoring episodes.
Yes.
If you don't count Time Squad, which we fudged with the main cast.
Oh, well, yeah, space.
But technically speaking, none of the guest cast in Time Squad appeared. But I cheated, so fine.
Well, as long as you know that.
Oh, yes.
That's the main
thing. And I admit it publicly, that damn you.
Hey, I don't disagree. It's your feature.
Absolutely. Okay, so I guess that's pretty much us done.
Have you any Geek Planet Online news to shill?
We do, yes. Our regular contributors, Mike and Ike, who you can follow on Twitter as It's Mike and Ike, are putting together a five-episode special of Mike and Ike's All-Star Summer Jamboree, which is going to be covering all five series of Battlestar Galactica. And for this, they have bagged a couple of really sweet interviews. They're going to be interviewing via email the man who composed all the incidental music for the show, Bear McCreary. But also, and this is quite a feather in the cap, they are going to be interviewing on the podcast, in person, Mr. Richard Hatch, who is the only actor who appeared both in the original Battlestar Galactica and the modern Battlestar Galactica. He was Apollo in the original Battlestar Galactica, and he was Tom Zarek in the Ronald Moore version.
Oh, as if you needed to tell me that.
Absolutely.
You did.
I know I did. There are times where I think you've only just come to terms with the idea of television. Moving pictures is witchcraft. Kill it.
Oh, please.
But yeah, so that's going to be coming up on Geek Planet Online soon. So keep an eye out for that. Mr. Wilson, anything new on Earth 2?
Earth 2. Well, a couple of things. We're about to lose a podcast in that Married to Movies is about to come to an end with its 50th episode, in that the family Reddick are a very busy bunch, and the format of having one film that one partner will hate and the other film that the other partner will hate was kind of just kind of grating on their social time. But they, you know, they've done 50 episodes.
It's a nice round number.
So that is ending, I believe, the week this goes out.
Right.
But it is around that time. But on Des's front, the male host of Married to Movies, in addition to doing the weekly Dread Media, he's also started doing his own kind of podcast. It's within the Dread Media podcast feed itself, but he's starting up a series called Dread Media Presents, where he is playing host to a number of other contributors and segments that he used to do on his podcast with other people. So he's been reviewing some old Marvel line there. I really should remember what it's... I think it's called Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah.
A very famous Dracula comic from the 70s, which...
I believe Tomb of Dracula featured at one point the first appearance of Blade.
Indeed. That episode has come up. He and Chris Johnson, who is a forumite on Earth 2... He has done podcasts in the past, but not associated to our site. So they've been going through each of those issues, five issues per episode, and then a fellow author of Desi's called Jeff Strand has his own segment, and Des and I have been in contact, and we're going to do something together for that in future sometime, so that'll be good fun. And whilst I am self-promoting, Comic Relief, the segment that started out my Earth 2 podcasting career, I've started to kick into gear again because it's we have a summer of comic book movies coming up. So hopefully, by the time this episode goes up, my warm-up episode reviewing The Mask and Son of the Mask should be up. And then I went to watch Thor last week as well. So
I'm going to be seeing that in a couple of days' time.
Ah, good stuff.
Only in 2D, mind.
Oh, I did it in 2D. Because earlier in the year, I watched The Green Hornet in 3D. And I don't know what was worse, the content or the 3D effects. So, yeah, I made sure I watched it in 2D. That, and I can't really afford a 3D showing. So, yes, well, I very much enjoyed Thor. So, hopefully you will have a blast.
Excellent. Well, I guess that pretty much rounds things up then for us. So,
yeah, I would say so.
Zen, has something happened to them?
Data is not available.
I don't want data. I want to know what's happening.
It will be necessary for you to make a personal investigation.
Well, you're a big help. Personal investigation. Personal investigation. Next time Avon wants to make a personal investigation on how you work, I shall make a personal point of handing in the instruments. Personally.
Next time, we are only going to be covering the one episode, which is going to be Aurak, but because Aurak closes out the first season, after we've reviewed the episode, we're going to be doing a bit of an overview of the first series.
Indeed we are.
And covering it, basically just covering our thoughts on the first series in general.
Yes.
So remember, if you have any feedback, you can either send that to shakenblake@geekplanetonline.com, or you can send it to...
That would be shakenblake@earth-2.net. And whilst I did say I wouldn't accept gushing praise, I've since consumed 2 beers and would like to rescind what I just said. Send in as much gushing praise that has bugger all to do with Blake 7 as possible. I don't care. Competition is everything. See you in Hell Geek Planet.
You utter megat.
Well, on that note, all that's left to be said is goodbye from me, Ian Wilson.
And from me, Dave Probert.
Cheerio.
It's not easy having yourself a good time. Greasing up those pets and feathers, watching your thing, don't want to let him fucking kiss you both at the same time. Whether you should live or die.
don't hang your head.